We are the world.
Okay, so we'll turn to the Parsha. It's lovely to see you all, at least on the screen. I look forward to the time we can see each other physically in person again. Those of you who I've seen crossing the street or near the shul or outside near the park, it's been a pleasure to see you. Please God, we'll all have the challenge of getting used to seeing other people again and what that's like in the very near future. So we'll turn to the parasha, which, in fact, as last week, we have two parashat Achremot and Kedoshim. And they are, in many ways, very different to last week's conjunction. Last week, we had Tazria and Metzora, which were, in many senses, complementary. They almost bled right into each other with the discussion of biblical leprosy, Tzaras, and the implications and the consequences and the ramifications and the curing procedure, the assessment procedure. They all kind of interdispersed across those two parsha with a couple of psukim at the beginning about the purity and impurity about birth. So in many ways, Tazria and Metzora are a pair. Achrimah and Kedoshim often come together, but their content is dramatically distinct. Achrimah is a parsha that is targeted toward the Kohanim almost entirely. It begins, but Achre, how does it begin? Anyone know the first pasuk? Somebody does. V'idabar Hashem al Moshe le'emor. That's the first pasuk. The next pasuk. Daber al kol adat b'nei. Oh, I'm reading the wrong pasuk. Anyway, nobody caught it.
Nobody noticed.
Somebody thought that's not the first pasuk. The first pasuk is V'idabar Hashem el Moshe, not le'emor. After the passing of Aaron's two sons, as they came close to God, and God says to Moses, and it's odd, two psukim in a row, it seems unnecessary. And what is Moses told to tell Aaron? Words that could not resonate more in our age. Al yavo b'chol et al hakodesh. You cannot at all times go into the sanctuary. Mibet leparochet, within the curtain. El panei kaparet asher aron al yamut velo yamut, and you shall not die. I'm not here to make links, coincidences, to make us feel chills down our back with prophetic implications. But this verse does resonate, saying that there are times that we are not allowed to go into the sanctuary lest we die. This is the only way that Aaron will go into the Kodesh, and then we're given the details of how Aaron would get into the sanctuary, which is the service of Yom Kippur. I'm not suggesting that if some of you start making incense in your backyards, the shul will reopen, and I wouldn't recommend that either. And please God, the time will come when we'll have time to reflect on the meaning beneath these verses. We then have the laying out of the service of Yom Kippur, which is the laning for Yom Kippur morning. It is not a deep reflection on the state of human penitence. It is a ritual guide to service in the Mikdash, and it's often a big challenge to find the text of laning on Yom Kippur morning to find a way to resonate with the spirit of the day as we experience it. We're not witness to the unfolding of ritual in the Bet Mikdash. We're witness to a solemn, sober, liturgical outpouring. And the text, we have to lean on heavily to bridge our current experience, which, please God, we will have the chance to do together in a few months' time. And then the Parsha from Achrimos moves on. As part of this, I should note, part of this service has one of the most radical performances in the Bet Mikdash. Twin goats were taken. They don't have to be actually biological twins. Two goats were taken, identical, were taken, lots were drawn, one of which was taken as a korban into the Bet Mikdash, and one of which was taken away into the Midbar and met a difficult end off a cliff. Anyone know what that second goat was taken towards?
Azazel.
Azazel. To Azazel. Now, what is Azazel? What does that term mean?
Purgatory.
purgatory. Interesting. There are, in fact, a whole series of views on what Azazel might mean. For some, it means Azar va'Azel, which is a description of topography. For the Rashbam, this is about a harsh and wilderness, barren land. That's what Azazel means. For one Midrash, it's actually to atone for the behavior of Uzzah and Azza, which are two angels we don't have to get into the esoterics of. But Azazel is a very strange name. But there is one view, hinted at by Saul, that Azazel is the name, it is a code name for a satanic angelic force, which is incredibly strange, that on the high point of Jewish spiritual, liturgical, ritual life, we seem to be engaging with behavior with a satanic demon. And why do we send a goat to Azazel? It's an odd move. In fact, the closest thing we have to it is what we mentioned last week with the Metzora. You have two birds, one of which is sacrificed as a korban, of one of which is released into the wild for the, we mentioned at the end, for the Chizkuni, also to meet an untimely end. And there we had all sorts of explanations why the bird is released. And it was actually mostly optimistic. The bird is released to reintegrate the Metzora into a life of speech, to bring him back and remind him of how he can do good in the world. Why are we releasing this goat into the Midbar? So we can turn back to this on Yom Kippur, but there are views that this is essentially metaphysical bribery. We send a goat out to distract Azazel from accusing us before God. And it is taken by the mystical commentators in that light. For those who are more rational and more based away from the Catholic or the angelic, it has to be read very differently, but I'll leave that for when we get to Yom Kippur. After we do Azazel, we have the rest of the Avodah on Yom Kippur, the blood being applied on the Mizbeach. Achrimos then turns to details of Korbanot generally, what Mumim are, the problems with that, the implication for Kisui Hadam. Anyone familiar with Kisui Hadam, the obligation?
Covering
the nodding head.
When you shecht the bird, you have to cover the blood.
Excellent, Jerry. Thank you. When you shecht, not just a bird, when you shecht a bird or a
animal,
chaya, a wild animal, you have to cover the blood, not a general behemoth. And there are all sorts of rules around covering the blood. Some of you may have seen this mitzvah being conducted. And in its essence, it is actually a form of burial to give a dignity. In some sense, there shouldn't be blood scattered on the floor. For some, it's less about dignity given to the bird and making sure that nobility lives in our behavior, that we shouldn't be scatterers of blood, but we should be covering our tracks when it comes to violence and when it comes to death. That's when it comes to Kisui Hadam. We then have the general prohibition on Chukat Akum. Anyone familiar with Chukat Akum? I see it on many lips.
Laws of the non-Jews.
Chukat Akum is exactly right. Obligations not to imitate practices of other cultures, other nations. This, as a halachic topic, has a number of ramifications and is discussed in circumstances one would not imagine. It came to mind a couple of days ago, Yom HaZikaron. There was the video some of us watched on Monday evening about the soldiers who were killed as they sought to go and protect the Etzion, the Gush Etzion area. And as part of the video, it showed the funeral where there were gun salutes afterwards. And there was a responsa written at the time, 1948, by the chief rabbi of Israel at the time, Rabbi Herzog, about whether Jewish soldiers were permitted at burials to conduct a gun salute, because that was the behavior of other nations. How did you show final dignity to those who were laid to rest who gave their lives for the country? You would do a gun salute. And there were questions about, can we do that? Is that a Jewish thing to do? Obviously, we don't have records from 2,000 years ago when last there were Jewish soldiers in a Jewish state who died and gave their life for the country. We have no record of how they were treated, how their burials were conducted. And his conclusion was that this was permitted. But this goes in all sorts of areas. And talking about current day crises, one of the main areas where Chukat Akum appears in everyday life. Anyone know where I'm going to turn?
So,
clothing. Clothing is a major thing. In fact, if you go to the more right-leaning parts of the Jewish community, this isn't always universally true, but you'll notice a lot of rabbis and rebbes don't look quite as spiffy as I might hear, because there is a refusal to wear ties, because that's a non-Jewish invention. Anyone know where ties were invented, by the way?
France.
Well, if it was France, I wouldn't wear them either. Yes, the French invention. It's actually interesting. It was, I'm told, invented in Thailand, but not Thailand as we think of it. It's translated as Thailand, Croatia. Originally, it was called a cravat or Croat, and Croatia is the place where the cravat or the tie was invented. Anyone ever worn a cravat? Sometimes people wear them at weddings. They've got ruffles and stuff. Originally invented to protect your shirt from stains, but now when we put the tie over our shoulder because we don't want the tie to get messy. But, you know, that's how things change in life. And actually, that's quite linked to the rules of Chukat Akum. Specifically, when there are practices that have no rational basis, meaning wearing a tie, there's a rational basis. It was to protect your shirt. There were reasons for its invention which give us confidence that this isn't linked to idolatry. But when there are practices that don't have a rational basis, that seem not to have some pragmatic element, there is a concern among the rabbinic legalists that there is the influence or the influx of idolatrous ideology, and we need to steer clear. I'll give you another Chukat Akum issue. Some of you, any of you wearing a jacket? I see Harvey's wearing a jacket, I think. Which side are the buttons on your jacket?
The opposite of the Hasidim. It's on the right side.
The Hasidim, if you see Hasidish jackets, they have, my buttons are on the right side. Hasidim have buttons on the left to avoid a Chukat Akum. Now, if there are any ladies online who are wearing a jacket, what side are your buttons on?
On the left.
On the left. So the Hasidim are trying not to do Chukat Akum, but they're doing Beged Isha. So you've got all sorts of questions flying around just in terms of what the buttons go. I'm not trying to cause aspersions to the entire group of Hasidim, but these are the questions that are debated among the commentators, from something as simple as don't do practices of other cultures. I should note that there is a specific exemption for a particular jacket or a particular coat that is allowed to be worn even though it was instituted by foreign cultures. Anyone know what I'm referring to?
A yekka?
A yekka has always got exemptions for everything, but actually, the exemption is doctors wearing a white coat. Because even though that seems to be just a uniform issue, it actually is to show who's in charge, who can make decisions in a room. It's also to protect hygiene and cleanliness. So there is a specific exemption in the legal text to permit doctors to wear white coats, even though it seems to be Chukat Akum. We don't have records in rabbinic or biblical literature of healers wearing white coats. In fact, the Kohen Gadol, we're told, wore a white clothing, but that was it. But there's an exemption made for that. That's Chukat Akum. And then Achremos folds out the rest of the parasha with what is a code of sexual ethics, the list of arayot that one is not allowed to engage in sexually, which also happens to be read on Yom Kippur in the afternoon. And talk about a challenge for a rabbi to draw inspiration from the text. You've got the morning, which is all the spilling of the blood and the killing of the calves and the blood on the altar. And then the afternoon is don't sleep with this one and don't sleep with that one. Like, okay, I guess I'll just tell a nice story. I'll figure something out to lift the crowd. But there's a lot to talk about that. And we'll leave that for Yom Kippur. Now, if this year were a leap year and we had to spend the entire time on Achremot, we'd have to figure out more to say about that. But we have Kedoshim, which is jam-packed with more stuff that we could possibly get through. And I've just seen the time, and we're going to have to press on quite speedily. Now, Kedoshim, I do want to read the opening pasuk, which I did a moment ago, by the Veshem and Moshe Lemor. The next pasuk tells us about the radical shift between Achremos and Kedoshim. Achremos, as we've said, a lot of these details are very ritually orientated towards the Kohanim. Kedoshim begins. Daber el kol adat b'nei Yisrael. Speak to the entire people of the Jewish, the children of Israel. Va'amant elehem, and tell them, kadoshim to you, Hashem elokeichem. Tell them they have to be holy. Now, what on earth does it mean, be holy? We get the sense of what's meant, but how do I put this into practice? What does it mean, be holy?
Be moral.
Be moral. Okay, so make morality a priority. And the truth is, that's precisely what Nachmanides says here, is that there are ways to be in fulfillment of Torah law and being immoral at the same time, which awakens a question about, is there a moral code beyond halachic life, which was debated by philosophers through Maimonides, Rabbi Lichtenstein. Anyone know Marvin Fox? Anyone know the name Rabbi Marvin Fox? He was a rabbi in Boston for a long time, and he had a debate in writing with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein about whether there is a moral code that is separate from halachic life, and I'll let you guess who thought which. But I imagine you might get it wrong. For those of you who don't know who Marvin Fox is, it would just be a 50-50. But it's an interesting debate. But here, Nachmanides says that's precisely what kadoshim means here. It's in Torah, is there ever a halachic principle that says don't be drunk all the time? No. There are, when is one not allowed to be drunk in Jewish law, in halacha?
Davening.
Whenever one's saying a bracha, one has to not be drunk, which is why Purim becomes an interesting question, because people drink a lot during the Suda. You have to bench at the end. So you can't bench while you're drunk. So that's meant to mitigate the force of that need to get drunk. Some, they just take a little nap. There's another time one isn't allowed to drink.
Duchening,
exactly. That's part of this as well. Now, why duchening in particular? Number one, there's a bracha involved, but what else? Where did duchening take place?
Took place in from the base by the base of Mikdash, and I guess it's a question of the issue of Ezra or something like that. Maybe it's a thing that they might do something wrong when they make the bracha.
Excellent. It was in the Bet Mikdash, and it is specifically prohibited. There's an isur shitui yayin. There is a prohibition on drinking wine when going into the Bet Mikdash itself. It is a prohibition. In fact, it is, as Jerry insinuated, it is the communication after Nadav and Avihu are taken up in this ball of fire, and God responds speaking only to Aaron. Vaydaber Hashem al Aaron lemor. He says, don't drink wine, which is why some of the commentators say that must be what Nadav and Avihu did. Otherwise, what's the connection? And anyone who may have heard of Immanuel Levinas, a French-Jewish philosopher, he wrote a book called Religion for Adults, in which he claimed that Jewish practice, Jewish life, Jewish thought crafts a religion which is not simplistic but complex and designed for adults. And one of his proof texts for this is the prohibition on wine. There are some faiths, he claims, that you are to get drunk when you enter into the holy sanctuary, where you are meant to have this epiphany, this release from inhibitions, this prophetic mist that envelops you. But in Jewish life, you have to be sober, you have to be somber, you have to be attentive when you get to that holy. You can't drink wine. So there's no prohibition on being drunk or drinking any other time. However, the Ramban, as an example, will say, but don't go around saying, oh, I'm a halachic Jew, I'm getting drunk all the time. That's kadoshim, to be sanctified, to be hallowed in one's life is to understand that there's law and there's moral code. And here there's a suggestion that sanctity should be important. Now, kadoshim has a lot going on. It tells us to respect our parents, to observe Shabbos. It tells us not to worship idols, to pay wages on time, not to trip up the blind or the deaf, to keep social obligations to the poor, to judge fairly, and to rebuke our fellows in ways that does not lead to sin. It tells us not to put different threads together, not to breed different animals together, not to plant different seeds together, not to turn to ghosts or magic. Anyone turned to ghosts lately? Good. Not to turn to ghosts or magic, not to eat from a tree that has been planted within the last 3 years, to keep honest weights and measures. And every one of these topics is weighted with debate and meaning and profundity, which we could spend an hour on in itself. But I'm going to share my screen with you in a moment. I want to focus on what is for many the core philosophical ethic that arises out of these two parashiyot. Which one am I talking about?
It's ocean to you.
Now this is an ethic that if someone were to say you, what is the central ethic of Jewish life? What might you say?
Love thy neighbor.
Love thy neighbor. V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. Excellent. And that is what comes up in this week's parasha. The context in which it comes up is worth debating in and of itself. It says, v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, and you shouldn't do kilayim. And the commentators are perplexed as to why this universal cosmic ethic of humanity and love is put in conjunction with planting odd seeds together, which the Rabbeinu Bachya and the Arachaim go into a lot, but we'll save that for another time, because I want to ask a fundamental question about this ethic. What does it mean? How does it live in practice? How am I meant to love my neighbor, my reacha, my friend, like myself? And to do that, I'm going to share my screen with you. I'm not going to be able to see all your faces, and you're not going to be able to see everybody's faces once this is being shared, but you should be free. You should feel free to make a comment, to call out, to contribute in any way, to ask questions. Now, so this is our parasha under pressure. Achrei Kedoshim. So we turn to our fundamental ethic of love. Lo tikom, do not take revenge. Velo titor, do not bear a grudge. Is that the same thing? Taking revenge and bearing a grudge?
No.
What's the difference?
One is action, one is internal.
Excellent. Taking revenge involves an act, and bearing a grudge is just an attitude, although it can be refracted through behavior as well. But those are two important obligations. That's the way the Rashbam breaks it down. Et b'nei amecha, do not take revenge, do not bear a grudge against the children of your people. And then we have the ethic. V'ahavta l're'acha kamocha. Love your friend like yourself. Ani Hashem, I am God. Now, of course, anyone not familiar who God is at this point reading the Chumash? If you just picked it up and you picked up Vayikra 19:19, you may not know what's going on. If you've started from Bereshit, we're quite familiar with God at this point. It's an odd thing to interpolate. V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your fellow as yourself. Ani Hashem, for the record, you should just know, I'm God. We know you're God. Why does it say Ani Hashem? I'll leave that floating for you to consider. Now, Rashi quotes the Midrash, which says on this, Amar Rabbi Akiva, Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah, as many of you insinuated at the start. This is the central general principle of the Torah. Love your neighbor like yourself. How else is this formulated? Anyone know the famous story involving this remark?
Hillel.
Yeah?
Hillel and Shammai. Someone came to him and said, teach me the Torah on one foot. And he said, if you watch, this is it.
Great. Excellent. A story that is recorded in multiple places, in Shabbat as well. There was a potential convert who came to the two leading figures of Jewish life, to Shammai and to Hillel, and he said, teach me the Torah on one foot. He said, if you stand on one foot, I'll think about it. He didn't say that. Shammai said, get out of here. I'm not teaching you the Torah on one foot. Who do you think you are? And Hillel said, okay, I'll teach you the Torah on one foot. And he said, he didn't say, ahavta l'recha kamocha. He actually expressed it in Aramaic in the opposite. Amar Hillel azakein. Hillel said, da'alach sane. What is hateful to you, l'chav reich lo tavid. Don't do to your friend. This is very different to saying love your neighbor like yourself. He's saying don't do hateful things to your neighbor. Seems to be at the very least, don't do hateful things to your friend. Zuhi kol ha-Torah kulan. He doesn't just say this is the klal, this is the general principle, but he says this is the entirety of the Torah. The iduch perusha, the rest of it is commentary. Zil gamor, go and learn. Now, let me ask you a question about intellectual honesty. Is everything in the Torah about loving your neighbor like yourself? Does it seem that way? Can you think of any possible examples that doesn't seem to merely be commentary on this ethic?
Amali.
Anything that isn't based on what Pharaoh.
Say again?
Anything that's not Beinatam L'chavero.
Right. There seems to be a lot of levels and layers and complexity to Jewish life that to even to attempt to summarize, one empathizes with Shammai, who said, get out of here. You can't summarize that. But even the impossibility of summary isn't the issue. There does seem to be the killing of, somebody mentioned the killing of Amalek, the killing of other nations. There seems to be times the death penalty. There are all sorts of things that seem to imply the v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your neighbor like yourself, isn't the operative soul principle of Jewish life. And there are, of course, ways of squaring that. And actually, in the context of the death penalty, v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha appears as a concept in the ways in which it's carried out. That if, imagine it were you who were being put to death, you would want to have the most lenient punishment, and that pushes the calculus as to which kind of death people get under certain circumstances. Having said that, there is another way to read this text. I've noted in the past that Rabbi Sacks has a book called Not in God's Name. I think I mentioned they actually had an event in the shul here with Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Sacks. It was on the occasion of the release of that book, I believe. And I'm told there are a number of the books somewhere in a cupboard that if you want to buy them, they're still available. And in that book, he has a small chapter called Hard Texts, in which he says that every faith that we know of has texts, sacred texts, that are difficult to square with moral vision. Whether it is coming up in Bamidbar, when Moshe tells the people to slaughter the Midianites, and they come back and they haven't killed some of the women, and Moshe gets irritated. He flies into a rage. Why didn't you kill the women? And for a moment, we're thinking, v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, this is Moshe telling the people you didn't kill enough people, go back and do more. What are we to do with that text? And Rabbi Sacks suggests that hard texts are implicit in every faith. And actually, what's central is the way that texts are read. And it strikes me that in order to give an interpretation to any text, you need an overarching principle about how to lean on the text, how to push value through the words. And here what Hillel is saying to this potential convert is, you want to know what the principle of Torah is? V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Everything else is commentary. So go to the text, begin to interpret, but interpret everything through this lens. He's not saying the whole Torah is a commentary on this. Of course it's not. There are parts of the Torah that don't seem to exemplify unmitigated love. But the way in which every sentence, every passage, every word, every letter should be read is through the lens of this unmitigated love. And that seems to be his instruction. Now, having said that, the idealism falls away for many of the commentators, because how on earth do I love somebody like I love myself? I should have put up here actually an image of Richard Dawkins, who wrote a book called The Selfish Gene, because it's hard to deny that coded into the human DNA code is an ego, is a narcissistic, self-preservative drive. And there are a number of commentators who we will now see who try to delimit what to do with this obligation to love everybody. Who is Reyach? I have to love everybody? Really? That's what I'm being... There are people who I can't stand. I'm obviously not myself saying somebody might say there are people I can't stand. I have an obligation to love them. And actually, I remember, before you read that, I'll hide that from you. When I was in college, undergrad, in an English literature class at YU. I can't remember why on earth this came up, but somebody mentioned, oh, they said, I've had a fascinating reading of V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your fellow like yourself. He said, this is how it should be read. V'ahavta l'reicha, love your friend kamocha, who is like you. Only love the people who are like you. If there are people you don't like, or people who don't fit your philosophy, the people who vote for the other side, you don't have to love them. You don't have to like them. The only people there's an obligation to love are the people who are kamocha, who are like you. And I made this kind of weird face in reaction, and he thought it was a face of approval, but it was not. It's a horrific reading, I found at the time. But there is this instinct on the commentators to delimit this obligation, which in it seems impossible. And here we have the Rashbam, who says, "V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha." What does a reacha mean here? Reacha hu im tovhu. You only have an obligation to love someone im tovhu, if they are good. Aval im lo im hu rasha. Not if the person's wicked. Hidichtiv, we have a verse that we often sing on Friday night. Yirat Hashem sinat ra. Yirei Hashem sinu ra is what we sing on Friday night, but this is a instantiation of that verse. Those who fear God should hate evil. And we spoke about this around Rosh Hashanah time, Shabbos HaGadol, that Rabbi Soloveitchik, Meir Soloveitchik, wrote a piece called The Virtue of Hate. And it seems to be for the Rashbam, there is a virtue of hate. You only have an obligation to love those who are good. If there are horrific terrorists in the world, if you find a neo-Nazi, you don't have to say, you know what, come here, let me give you a hug. You don't have obligation to love them. That's the way the Rashbam reads that, although we'll see that others may disagree. Now, having made that delineation, the Panach Raza is going to make an even more radical suggestion. He's going to say, hold on a minute. Every day in Kriya Shema, we make a statement that we have to love God. How does that statement go? We say, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. We say, Baruch Shem under our breath. Then what do we say? Va'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. We don't say Va'ahavta la'Hashem Elokecha. Say Va'ahavta et. It should here be Va'ahavta et Re'acha. And the Panach Raza says, Re'acha lo ketiv, ela lo re'acha. It says, you shall love lo re'acha, to your friend. What does it mean to love at my friend, to love to my friend? Should say, v'ahavta et re'acha. And this is his answer. Klomar, hashayach lo re'acha. You have to love that which belongs to your friend. Dehainu she'mamano chaviv alecha v'latzilo kashalach. The obligation here, he has now reduced this cosmic ethic into something about property rights. The only thing we have an obligation to love is that which is l're'acha, that which belongs to my friend. Am I echoing?
No.
Okay, good. The obligation here for the Panach Raza is not to love every person, but to love every person's property. I shouldn't see that there's a fire blazing and I can save somebody's computer. It's not mine. I'll leave it. I have an obligation to love other people's property like I love my own. This is an ethic in a different realm, on a different level, in a different plane than Rabbi Akiva, and Rashi seems to be treating it for the Panach Raza. I can't be that I'm being asked to love people, all people. I can't love all people. I just have to treat their property with respect. The Malbim and Rav Hirsch take a similar view, not about property, but to life events. The Malbim makes the same remark about Lamed, and then he finishes off underlined, Sheyirtza lechavera, we have an obligation to want for our friends, ma sheyirtza la'atzma, that which we would want for ourselves. We want to win the lottery, we should want them to win the lottery. We don't have to have a deep love affair with each human being on the planet, we just have to want their life to go well. And Rav Hirsch makes the same point. L're'echa, he says, Eineno ishu toshel hasheni. This doesn't apply to the personality of the other. Elakol ha-magia aleshiyoto, but that which happens to them. Kol ha-tana'im ha-kove'im et ma'amad chayav. All the conditions which set up their life. That's which we have to love. Nidrash shlomo v'tavato. We should seek their peace and their good. Nismach ba'oshro. We should celebrate in their joy. V'nitatsev b'tzaharo. And we should be sad at their pain, keilu iru advarim lanu, as if it happened to us. So there is a limitation on this page of sources. It says this obligation to love, hafda l'reicha kamocha, is in fact a very limited obligation. For the Rashbam, it's limited to the righteous and the pious. And who on earth can meet that bar? Number one. Number two, we have the Panach Raza, who says this is really just a command to respect other people's property, like we respect our own. And then Malbim and Rav Hirsch suggest that this is not about people, This is about circumstances. We should wish everybody well. That's the way that these read it. But now we come to another set of readings. And we begin with the Hakatava Kabbalah. And here again, they're all fighting to reduce the extent of this obligation. And we'll see in words in one of the commentators in a minute, the expression of this question, how could God ask us to love someone like we love ourselves? Understood on a psychological human level, it is an impossible calling. For me to love other people on the same level that I love myself is neurologically, physiologically, psychologically, emotionally, an impossible ask. For God, what can it mean? Which is why we had the Rashban limit it to the pious beyond our reach, the Panach Raza limit it to just a respect for property, and the Malbim and Rav Hirsch to make it a wish for good circumstances globally. And now we have the Ketava Kabbalah, who addresses it head on. And we'll just read some of the underlined bits. He says, look at the penultimate line where the mouse is. Lefi zeh, according to what he's just said above. Firstly, he points out, we'll read underlined, he says, Yesh omrim, some say, chamocha al derech hafla gav gutma. This is just hyperbole. God is not being specific. When he says love other people like yourself, he doesn't mean literally love them like you like yourself. That's impossible. He's saying, just like other people. He says, I don't buy that. God isn't hyperbolic. God doesn't just, he doesn't go over the top. Number one. Number two, some people read it, imato hefsus tein lo. The kamocha means you should love them in the ways that you love yourself. You should buy their birthday gifts, the kind of birthday gifts you would like. So if you'd like an Xbox, you should buy them an Xbox. If you like, in his words, horses, give them a horse. What does that not seem to account for?
Their desires.
Yeah, they not liking horses. You can buy them a horse and say, that's very kind of you, but this is my 95th birthday. I don't plan to go horse riding anytime soon. So it's an odd reading, but it's a way to resolve the weight of that word. Love another kamocha like you love yourself. It's an impossible task. So some people have said it's guzme, it's just hyperbole. Some people have said actually it's mimetic. It means you should love them in the same ways that you love yourself. You like horses, buy them horses. You like restaurants, buy them restaurants. Don't ask again, what gift should I get them? Just get whatever you'd like. But he finishes and says, this is what it really means. Hamechaven b'milat kamocha. When we say love your fellow like yourself, it just means kamo ata, in the same ways that you would like to be loved. Klomar, meaning ha'aval re'echa, you should love your friend, b'chol otana ofanim kamocha, in the same ways that you would like to be loved. Kamosha atama vageshet ha'ava mariach. This is just to say that there should be reciprocal love. You don't have to love them like you love yourself, which is an impossible calling, but in the same ways, kamocha, that you would like other people to love you, you should love them. In the realistic way that you hope human beings have enough space in their ego to make room for other people, that's the way in which you should make room for other people too. The Emek Dava, we won't read inside, but he suggests, actually, kamocha is a metaphor. You should love other people, kamocha, as if they were part of you, which means that hating other people is essentially self-destructive. The example he gives based on a midrash is that if your hand spills a drink and you're irritated, this happened to me today, I spilled a drink nearly over my wife's computer, not a brilliant moment on my part. So what do I do to my hand? My hand did something wrong. What should I do to my hand?
Smack it.
Nothing. It's my hand. It hurts me if I do something to my hand. And the Emek Dava says, that's precisely what this means. Love your fellow kamocha as if they were part of you. See any vengeance, see any grudge, see any negative behavior as self-destructive. Because in essence, we are all part of a nation, we're all part of a people, we're all part of humanity. And to hate other people is to bring humanity down, just it's self-destructive. Love them as if they were a limb, as if they were part of you. That's the way he deals with this. Now we're going to turn to the modern age. We have 4 minutes left. And in the modern age, we have Rav Naftali Hertz Wiesel, who I mentioned a couple times on Shabbat afternoon over Suda Shlishit, Sacred Texts Under Threat. And this is the way he asks our question, which we've stated. Im kavanat ha-pasuk, she'ahev kol adam. If the intention of the verse that asks me to love every person, ka'ashev ahev et atzmo, is that the way that I love myself, yipale ma'od. It is astonishing. It is incredible. Not in the incredible, that's great, but in the incredible, it's not credible. She'itzavenu al davar, that we should be commanded on something, she'inu b'koch shem nefesh, that is not within the power of any soul. We are not empowered to exude that kind of care, that kind of attention, that kind of love to others. It is impossible for a human being to love the other. And even more, ishnochrilo, a stranger, someone they don't know, in a way that they love themselves. It's impossible. Number one, he says. Number two, gam, einatzavot elahava v'sina. We should not be getting commands about love and hate. Generally, even if it said, don't love them like you love yourself, just va'ahavta et re'acha. That shouldn't be a command either. She'ein ha'adam moshel aleihem. We don't control who we love. We don't control who we hate, as is testified to in hundreds of Hollywood movies. I don't control who I love. I fall in love. So how can I have a command to love somebody? Question number two. Question number three, va'od, he says, Im Cain, and this speaks to the age in which he lived in the 1700s when Jews were still being persecuted. He says, Im Cain, if I'm being told to love another like I love myself, tzarich shiit abel al tzara shel zulato, that I have to then lament, I have to mourn on the pain for other people, me'al tzarat nafsho, as if it were my own loss. V'chayav einam chayim, life would not be life. She'in l'chasha, there is no moment, shelo yira'ev lo yishma b'tzarat acher. And specifically in our age, when we see the number in the corner of the news screen ticking up every moment, if I have to love everybody on this planet in the way that I love myself, I would never get to breathe. I would be in a constant state of lamentation and despair at other people's pain. How can it be? He then finishes off with a narrative question. If we are commanded to love others like we love ourselves, for anybody who's read the beginning of the book of Shmuel Bet, Ma Pele, what kind of amazing turn is it? Ba'avat David v'Yonatan, in the love affair between David and Jonathan, who sing liturgical poems to each other out of the depth of their love. How great is that? Why is that so good? And Kol Yisrael chayv la'ahav v'reo kanafsho. Everybody is commanded to love everybody else. What makes David and Jonathan so special? So that's his cluster of questions about what we ordinarily treat as a straightforward ethic, to love other people like we love ourselves. Says number one, it is impossible to express that kind of love and care for another person. Number two, how can we be commanded to express emotion on any level? Number three, I would be mired in mourning all my life. And number four, what's so special about David and Jonathan? And his answer is as follows. We can't read it all, but he says, "V'haftal arecha kamocha, love another like yourself." He says, does not mean I have to express the love that I have for myself for other people. It is a qualification of who I am meant to love. Ahavta l'reicha kamocha, I should love l'reicha, to the other. Kamocha, who is like you? How is that other like me? Hadomela shenivra gamhu b'tzelem elokim, that they are forged in the image of God. V'haryu Adam kamocha, v'zeh kolel l'chol b'nei Adam, and this includes every human being, shukolam nivra'im b'tzelem. This is the opposite reading of the way that my friend in English class read this verse. When my friend in English class, you see it's 9:16, we're going to wrap up in 1 second, that my friend in English class said, v'hafta l'recha kamocha means, love your friend who is like you. Meaning, who is like you? The people who you identify with. And here, Rav Naftali Wiesel is saying you should love other people who are like you. How are they like you? They're human. In the very most basic sense, they're human. And we're not going to read it all, but the Ramban here, Rav Moshe ben Menachem. Who's Rav Moshe ben Menachem? He was the son of Menachem Mendel, the son of Mendel. Mendel's son. This is Moses Mendelssohn in his commentary. Where he takes Wiesel to task and proposes a radically different reading we don't have time for. Shadal responds with Shmuel David Lozotto by saying that Mendelssohn essentially takes the approach of the Sodomites. And then we turn to the Ramban, who we would have finished with, who gives a simple answer at the very end. What does it mean to love others like ourselves? Lo yiten shiurin ba'ahava. and there's a nice tape measure there under the word love, that when we love, it shouldn't be measured. It shouldn't be, I only want a certain amount of goodness to come their way. It should be just effusive in its context. It's 9:17, so I'm going to stop there. I'm going to wish you all a Shabbat Shalom, and I am happy to take any questions.